Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. It's a sports day today on the program, and we're going to start by talking about the storied history of the Madison Mallards baseball team today. And a couple of guests for you to start the show. The author of the book, Baseball Like It Ought to Be, is one of our guests, Tom Alicia. Tom's a former longtime arts and entertainment writer, editor of Madison Daily Newspapers, won a National Music Journalism Award. And he has also written Beauty at Short about Dave Bancroft. And we had you on about that.
Yeah, Superior, Wisconsin's Dave Bancroft.
And now it's the Madison Mallards, and so it's great to have you with us today, Tom. And with us well, one of the guys that Tom wrote about a fair amount is Vern Stenman. And Vern's been, I think we were, 4 years ago or so? Something like that. President of the Madison Mallards and the Madison Nightmares. And Vern, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Also president, I think, of Big Top Events.
The Mallards, yeah, basically.
The Mallards, basically. And as we talk with our two guests, want to hear from you. Let us know why maybe you love the Mallards or the Eau Claire Express or the La Crosse Loggers or the Kenosha Kingfish or some of the other teams from the Northwest Baseball League. It's really a wonderful success story, and that'll be part of our conversation today, I'm sure. But let us know what questions you might have, or maybe just a comment about one of the teams, the Mallards or the Express or the Loggers or any of them. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Tom, just start with you for a minute. What inspired you to write about the Mallards?
You know, it's as a Madison resident, every year I'm fascinated by the fact that the Madison Mallards continue to draw more than 200,000 fans a season. And to put that in perspective, there are 80 collegiate summer leagues nationwide, hundreds of teams, and no one is near them. And what should happen is it should start to tail off a little interest, but instead
it's bigger.
The interest just keeps going and going and going. And they did it without becoming the Savannah Bananas and going out truly outlandish on the field. So that success fascinated me. And sure enough, it turned into a very entertaining and fun book.
Oh, yeah. It's full of details and funny stories. And you must have done a lot of research for this.
Yeah,
you talked to a whole bunch of people, including probably Vern.
I did a lot of interviews with Vern, a lot of interviews with the team owner, the original team owner, who is still the owner, and that is Steve Schmidt. And getting to interview both of them and digging into their stories was probably one of the most enjoyable parts of the book.
I would guess so. Vern, you... That first Mallards game, what was that like?
It's a good question. It was cool because in that moment, no one expected us to succeed. You know, it's hard probably for a lot of people to go back to that moment in time, but there had been three teams that had failed at Warner Park in I think the previous 7 years. Yeah. Before we came in, I was 23 years old. Steve had never done anything really in the sports and entertainment space before. And we didn't know what we didn't know, I guess, you know, and we just said, let's go out and let's have fun. You know, Steve brought this really cool customer service focus. I kind of brought a lot of the fun promotional side of it and tried to do new things. And for a 23-year-old kid, putting him in that kind of atmosphere where you could try anything, and if it worked, that was great. And if you failed, nobody was paying attention anyway, so who really cares? And so it was really a fun time. That first game, you know, I think we drew right around 1,000 fans to that very first game. And at the time, that was a great crowd. You know, that was a good night. Now, we go on to play the rest of the month of June, and I don't think we get a crowd over 200. You know, so we were probably a little overly excited by that first night. But, you know, it was always fun, and that's been kind of the common thread, I think, from that very first day, you know, until, you know, right now.
Yeah. Tom, what stands out to you about the Mallards?
You know, I think that Steve Schmidt's commitment, the team has done well, and then the team has done well financially. And Steve Schmidt, instead of walking away, and this is true of Vern too, they didn't just stop and cash in. Steve Schmidt in particular keeps putting the profits that he makes and the money in back into the team. And that's what makes it so exciting. There's a video board that was put up last year that I think would be an envy of just about every single minor league team and maybe one or two major league teams. It's enormous. It's an incredible part of what they've done with Warner Park. And one of the things I liked about it, you got to go back to when Vern's talking about that first game, that first year, 2001. Warner Park was not the Warner Park that it is today. Warner Park, the Duck Pond, was a very struggling facility, and over the years, Steve has put in money to make sure that it is a fantastic facility.
I think about $10 million, if I'm not mistaken, from your book.
He's done a lot. He's done a lot for it. And it's in part because of his success. Of people who don't know Steve Schmidt, he is the very longtime owner, many decades, of the shoebox in Black Earth. It's sort of the iconic rural shoe store. And that's sort of his business, and this is what he's put a lot of attention into, and it's paid off.
You know, I've got a personal story about Steve Schmidt, which I think it captures a little bit of what he's like. I had a colleague who was from another country, Arab country, went out there to buy shoes for his whole family. Well, and there were like six family members. He bought like 10 pairs of shoes, and he goes to his credit card, and Steve said, "No, we don't." And he said, "I don't have my checkbook with me." And Steve said to him, "Oh, that's all right. Just mail us a check. You can take the shoes now."
It's funny you say that, because I've heard that exact same story from people directly, but from different countries and different places. And, you know, that focus on customer service, you know, I think is kind of unique in sports. You know, when's the last time you went to a Packers game and walked out saying, "Man, they took really good care of me"? You know, like, and that's that focus that Steve brought through his time with the shoebox. I think was very important from day one for us, and something that, again, I think is a little bit different with what we do and how we train our staff still to this day than you see with a lot of, you know, sports teams across the country.
And Tom, you're right about Steve and the name, the Mallards. Yes. It goes back. It's a fun story. Yes. How he came up with that name.
Well, he was one of the eight owners of minor league hockey team called the Madison Kodiaks. And they lasted one season in the late 90s. They were not successful. All of the owners lost some money. And but one team caught his eye, and it was the Quad Cities Mallards, a minor league hockey team that came to Madison, and when they came to Madison, they would also bring two or three busloads of their fans, and their fans just loved it. And to Steve, that's what he wanted then when he began owning a baseball team. He wanted that kind of enjoyment from fans. And as a result, and almost as a homage to the to the hockey team the inspiration. He wanted the team called Mallards because there were a lot of different names that were tossed out. Steve just says a lot of dairy. So you can imagine, you know, Moo, Milkman, right down the line.
It was a fun story. Tom in Madison has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, gentlemen. I hope you all have a safe and happy Fourth.
Thank you. You as well.
Thank you. My son, Patrick, spent a couple seasons as one of the Maynard the Mallard mascots, and he thoroughly enjoyed it, other than the heat at times. He would say things like, "Dad, when I'm in this duck outfit, it's very difficult to wipe the smile off my face." not only did he get us to the ballpark more, but he just had such a great time. I would highly recommend, if there's any younger people that are interested in stuff like that, contact the organization and look into it. If you've got any athleticism, any cheer, any of that kind of stuff, you will not quit smiling when you've got kids surrounding you and you're bending down to take pictures. And it's just, what a great experience for him. And I really thank you guys for giving him that opportunity.
Oh, well, Vern, a comment from you.
The employment side of things is something we don't talk a whole lot about, you know, but it's something we're really proud of. You know, every year we hire over 350 part-time employees. We have 26 full-time employees working for the team. And a really fun story is I think we have 6 people on our full-time staff today that started out as part-timers when they were like 14 or 15 years old and have worked their way through, come back every summer, go to college, get their degree, and then we bring them in to work full-time for us. So the guy running our concessions business today, he's only 26 years old, which is pretty young, to be doing what we're doing, but he's been working for us for 11 years because he started out when he was 14, and so we love that part of it. It is a fun place to work, and that's a huge focus. So I love to hear it, and I remember Patrick as our mascot. He was outstanding.
And as part of their outrageousness is Maynard comes off a zip line to open the game.
It's very cool.
One of my favorite stories, and I think Tom tells this one maybe, but is years ago, we rebuilt the stadium kind of in 2011, and we had problems with our zip line halfway through the year. We had to stop using it. And so there was probably 15, 20 games in 2011 that we didn't have the zip line mascot at the end of our season. And we had a season ticket holder that fall call us up in September and say, "You know what? I love the Mallards. Everything's great, but I'm not buying my season tickets to your baseball team until you tell me that the ziplining duck is going to be back in operation next year." And that for me always kind of summed up what Mallards were. You know, yeah, he loves baseball, this fan, obviously, but he also wanted that entertainment and that fun. And like, I'm not even coming if I don't get the ziplining duck.
And Maynard Mallard was the first bobblehead, was he not, Tom?
Yeah, he was. But one of the things about the Mallards, and they've had a lot of bobbleheads over the years, and some of them very creative, but one story stands out about the team's commitment to its fans, and that is bobbleheads that they had in, I believe it was 2003 or 2004, were on their way by truck from California. The truck broke down in North Platte, Nebraska. The Mallards on that night knew, or on that day knew, the truck broke down and would not be able to reach Madison in time. Steve, Vern, and the Mallards staff then hired a private plane in North Platte, Nebraska, which arrived at Dane County Airport, not too far from the duck pond. And by the third inning, I believe, the bobbleheads arrived.
Yep. It's funny, Tom, you mentioned that story because we had a similar thing come up this year, this spring.
Is that right?
So with all the tariffs and things like that, we do import bobbleheads. You can't find them made in bulk in the U.S., so you have to import them typically from China. And as everyone knows, you know, this has been a hectic few months in that space, to put it mildly. And so we, this Saturday night, we have a fun promotion called, we're rebranding ourselves as the Madison Neverminds, to kind of pay tribute to the band Nirvana recording the album Nevermind originally in Madison. And one of our staff came up with this brilliant idea of doing a snow globe that has Maynard as a baby in it, kind of floating in the water, very similarly to what the cover of that album looked like from the early 90s. And so mid-May, the supplier calls us up and says, we're worried about timing because of all the complications with shipping. And so I sat down with my staff, and it was going to cost us an extra $6,000 or $7,000 to fly these things in from China. And I sat down and I said, okay, do we have budget? Can we do this? And the staff is like, well, we just read the book. I don't think a budget really matters. We're doing this, right? So we flew these things in again this time. And so this Saturday night, the first 1,000 fans are going to get this really cool, you know, it's like a ceramic kind of a bobblehead type material inside this snow globe with blue snow to kind of emulate the cover of this iconic Nirvana album. And our players will be wearing these uniforms that'll look like the cover of the album, but our duck will be swimming in this pool of water. And again, like, it's fun, you know, and that's the common denominator from day one to today. And all the things that I think Tom captured very nicely in the book is that, you know, and Steve has said this to me multiple times over the years, like, if we're not having fun doing something in the work that we're in, we probably shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's become a rallying cry for us as well.
Tom Alicia, his book is titled Baseball Like It Oughta Be. And so he's with us today, as is Vern Stenman, who has been with the Mallards since the beginning. Started as a young guy, and now he's an older guy. It's been 25 years or so. And so he is president of the Madison Mallards and the Nightmares as well. And you can join in. Jim from Madison, we'll get to you in just a bit, but you can join in too at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We'll be talking about disc golfing a bit later on in the show, along in about 20 minutes or so. But right now we're talking about the Madison Mallards and the book that Tom Alicia wrote. It's Baseball Like It Oughta Be, How a Shoe Salesman's Madison Mallards and His Renegade Staff Ignited a Summer Collegiate Baseball Revolution. That's the title of the book. It's great to have him with us, as well as Vern Stenman, who is really one of the guiding lights behind, I guess we could say, behind the Madison Mallards and other ventures as well. You can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Let's give Jim and Madison a chance to join in. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning, Larry. And boy, what a wonderful and joyful subject to have, talking about baseball in Madison. You know, I have to tell you, I've been a longtime resident and have followed Madison when they were the Muskies, the Black Wolf, and of course now the Mallards, and have all the pennants in the garage and all of it. And it's just, I can't think of a better way to spend a summer night. And, you know, it's been, I think, for many of us, just a rite of passage for our kids, taking them out as kids and, you know, getting them to appreciate baseball. Keep in mind, these are college players that play in the North League. And so, you know, they're not professionals. Many aspire to be, but they're just good baseball players. And many of them, at least they used to live with families right in the Isthmus where I live. And so there's real connection to the community. But the thing I'd want to say about it is that I love the upgrades to Warner Park. I love everything that Mr. Schmidt, Mr. Stenman have done. I'm going to have to get Tom's book. If I have any complaint at all about the evolution of baseball in Madison, it's not peculiar to Madison. It's probably a sign of our times. But that is that one of the reasons you go watch a baseball game is to enjoy the summer night and take in baseball. And there's just so much overstimulation now between innings. And it's sort of like, you know, unless there's sound or music or a contest or somebody chasing somebody, people, I guess, get bored. I don't think that's the case. And I would suggest that if it would be possible, and of course I've got jets flying over me right now, I would suggest if it's possible, if you could have just a inning or, you know, between the fourth and the fifth inning, where there's just quiet and people can just listen to baseball and talk to each other.
Sure.
That would be a nice respite from all the overstimulation. But other than that, I love every minute of it.
And I'm with you on that, because I'm a baseball fan first myself, and we're always trying to find that balance. And actually, in the last year and a half, we've pulled back a lot. We used to do music in between every single pitch, and we don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. We have a live organ player now that we have had periodically, but not every year over the years. And most of our music in between at bats and things like that is now a live organ. And so you're right. I think that trying to find that balance has always been what the Mallards have been focused on. You know, we're not going to be the bananas and have our guys dancing in between every at bat or whatever, but we're also not the Brewers, and we understand that, you know. And so you're right, we got to continue to find that right balance. And I think you bring up some great points, and it's absolutely on our mind and something my staff and I are talking about almost every single day, how to find that right balance.
But Tom, I turn to you for a minute, because you write about the many, many ways, and Vern, of course, can back this up, that make the game more than a game. Just a lot of fun community kind of thing, and the giveaways and everything that go on are amazing.
Yeah, I mean, some of the promotions have been absolutely outrageous. They did the world's largest old fashioned 2 years ago. 1 year they did, they let fans, if they got a permanent logo of the Mallards tattooed, that they would be allowed for free in the duck blind. The duck blind is all you can eat, all you can drink. 40 people took them up on it.
Yep.
There was still a line. They weren't able to get a tattoo on everybody. There's the green morph suit, green, a person in an all green outfit between innings, jumping onto the field. Everybody in that stadium thought it was real. This is about 12 years ago, 12, 13 years ago. I saw it on YouTube. I thought it was real. And he runs across, and then six of the Mallards employees, all looking like security, never caught him, and he exited the stadium. The public address announcer played it perfectly. It was just, it was beautifully done. It ended up being on Jimmy Kimmel on his show that night on national TV. So they do a lot of things that are a lot of fun, even when they're making stuff up, which in the green morph suit is one of my favorite ones.
But where did I see the picture of the wiener on the bus?
Yes.
Yeah.
Bird, maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah. This goes back to the Muskies, where every time there's a foul ball, the PA announcer would say wiener. And there's an explanation early in the night, if you pay attention, where if you bring your foul ball that you catch in the stands or track down someplace in the stadium, you bring it to our concession stand, you get a free hot dog. And it started out with the Muskies. Yeah. Is really a cost saving measure. You know, like, this wasn't meant to be brilliant marketing. It was like, just please bring us the baseball back, because we can't afford to have any more baseballs lost. And And so we kept it going. I mean, I wish this were our tradition, but it's not. You know, we took it. I think we've built on it and kind of made it our own. And still to this day, every time there's a foul ball that goes into the stands, it says Wiener. Last year, we took a big chunk of our advertising budget and put it on a bus. It just said Wiener with a picture of Maynard. And if you didn't get the joke, like, you didn't get the joke, and it was kind of a waste of time. And I remember our marketing staff put it up on Twitter and said, yes, we spent almost our entire advertising budget on this. And we're proud of it. And it went viral online because people just thought it was so ludicrous, you know. And again, it kind of fit within that, you know, is that kind of fun, you know, type approach. And you know, we're super, we continue to have a lot of fun with that part of it.
Well, and you have T-shirt and you write about that too, Tom. T-shirt tosses, wiener tosses, bratwurst tosses.
It goes on and on. They were playing a team called the Alexandria Beatles, and fans could get in for free if they ate an edible bug, and many did.
250.
250.
We ran out of Beatles, and I'll never forget, there were like pretty young college girls coming up and eating Beatles, and I was giving them to them, and they were like mad that they didn't get the bigger Beatle, you know. It was a weird thing. And it's funny, that actually led to the Parks Commission in Madison requiring us to get permission for all of our promotions moving forward. Somebody on the Parks Commission didn't think it was as funny as I thought it was. And ever since we did that back in probably 2012 maybe or something like that, we have to go every January to the Parks Commission with our ideas and make sure that they're all comfortable with the things that we're doing. But that actually got us international media attention when we did the stupid little beetle thing. And so you got a free duck blind ticket again with that one as well. So you eat the beetle. We had 250 of them. We had another 250 people in line at that game to eat the beetle to get the free duck blind ticket.
Oh, man. And the duck blind itself, as you write about, Tom, it was 2017, I think it was, that the duck blind?
No, that was the 2017 was the main renovation.
Main renovation.
The duck blind has been with...
Yeah, a lot longer than that.
From the beginning.
Yep, 2001, there was some version of it. It's evolved a lot over the years. In 2017, you know, we always feel like we want to be reflective of the city of Madison and the things that are important to this community. And the Busch Light Duck Blind Project is one of those things that I'm really proud of, because we took 44 recycled shipping containers and custom fabricated them into this massive party space that we can put almost 2,000 people in, between private spaces and general admission spaces. And, you know, it's fun. It's a little bit weird. I think it's the only a permanent structure in all of sports in the world that's actually made out of shipping containers. And I think Madison cares about those kinds of things. And we think we actually operate in the most recycled stadium in the entire country, because we've used all kinds of different recycled parts to put our facility together over the years. And I think that hopefully people in Madison care about those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And the duck blind, it's part of major part of the reason for the Mallard's success over the years. But what it does is it allowed an adult audience, a partying crowd, to have their space, right field, along the right field line. At the same time, that's separated then from the family element of the audience, of the crowd, of which there's a significant portion of the fans. So they've gotten both of it. There's and that's part of the charm of the duck pond. It appeals to many.
And it's an all-you-can-eat-and-drink venue, too, which maybe we didn't detail. Yes. But, you know, we have 25 different styles of beer available out there, and then ballpark food all included for one price. And it's funny, because we were not the first team to do that in the country, but we were amongst the first teams in the country to do something like that back in 2001. And now you see that at major league venues, you know. And so we like to kind of take these kinds of risks over the years and see what kind of works and test it out. And kind of hopefully we can set some trends as well.
And what I also liked about it, and Tom, you wrote about this, that the over serving, let's put it that way, that there are arrangements and so forth for people. And you wrote about that.
Yeah, some, you know, there's a, and this came from a story Vern had told, that, you know, he would see a good handful, a dozen, two dozen cars left behind wisely. You know, it can be, you know, when you get all you can drink in Madison, is it can be a dangerous combination. But there's no doubt over the years that the Mallards have made sure, in terms of security and other factors, that, you know, that they can keep that running without it getting completely out of hand. I think at other places it would get far more out of hand.
Yeah, because there really hasn't been an issue in the 25 years.
I hate to say things like this, you know, I'll knock on wood if this is a wood table here, but we have not had, so we work really closely with the Madison Police Department, and every year we talk to them and say, hey, did you have any issues last year? We have off-duty officers working at every game, they've never tied a DUI to our stadium, you know, which I think speaks to some of the things we're doing from a planning perspective. But I think it speaks to Madison as well, you know, that, yeah, they're going to have fun. They're going to party a little bit, but they're going to be smart. And that's something that we're very proud to have that kind of fan.
I want to, there's one story that you told in the book that I'm sure Steve is quite familiar with, too, is the Gary Coleman story. Oh, okay. Yes. As an example of the kinds of things that are in the book, I think that Gary Coleman is a good one.
It's a chapter, actually.
Yeah.
It's called The Gary Coleman Lesson. And this is a story, and this was, again, getting to interview Steve and Vern at such length. There were some extremely, extremely funny stories over the years, successes and some that weren't as successful. The Gary Coleman one probably would be somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. Gary Coleman was brought in to make an appearance. A lot of celebrities, B-list celebrities, you know, would do that. Gary Coleman would be probably a more prominent one. Vern wanted Gary to take an at-bat, and Gary didn't want to, at least initially. Vern was able to convince him. he had written a script. Everything went well, and the umpire made a comment. The umpire who was in on it, the opposing coach who was in on it, Gary Coleman who was in on it, and the, you know, the umpire may have said something about Gary Coleman's height that bothered him. It's tough to watch because I have seen it on, you know, on YouTube as the entire clip. And Gary Coleman, after it said to him about his size, he jumps up and down. It's one of the funnier things that he's done, to argue with the umpire. But, you know, in the end, and Vern can talk to this too, was that the lesson was that it got national attention by ESPN. It got national attention by Fox Sports. But it was a national story, and the Mallards are very much a local team. And that local team, that local, being part of that local community, is what draws fans, not a fact that you got, were on the news on ESPN Sports Center.
Yep. And the thing that stands out to me is that wasn't a stretch where we were very used to selling out every single night. We were getting 6,500 fans every single night. And that was a Friday night in July, I think. And we did not sell out. We weren't even close to selling that game out. And it had always been a goal of ours to get on ESPN. You know, what minor league sports promoter wouldn't want to get their team name on ESPN somehow? And it's the lesson that we pulled from it. And I think Tom does a nice job talking about this. Again, it's like we talk about being reflective of the city of Madison and what matters to them. And they didn't really care that we were doing this, you know. That the idea of seeing Gary Coleman get thrown out of a baseball game for whatever reason wasn't appealing to people in Madison. And so I think that over time, what we learn here is, you know, Tom mentioned the world's largest old-fashioned. You know what? People in Madison care about the world's largest old-fashioned. old-fashioned, and we had thousands of people come out, sold the stadium out because they have pride in that. But do they have that same pride in Gary Coleman getting thrown out of a baseball game? No. We didn't get national publicity with the old-fashioned thing that we did a few years ago, but we got great attention in Madison. We got great traction in this community, and those are the kinds of things that, you know, have really become our focus over time, and a big thing that we've learned as we go.
Yeah, it was funny. You used a 6-foot long baseball bat.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Stirring stick.
Stirring stick. Oh my gosh. Well, the book is so much fun to read, and of course the Mallards are so much fun to go and see play, and I think, and one of the things that struck me in the book, you mentioned how many games that Steve Schmidt has attended.
Steve Schmidt has missed over the years, in 25 years, 5 home games. Yep. And
that's like 800 games or something.
Yes, over 800 games.
Yeah.
I said, what were the 5? What happened? And he had a reason for each of them. But my favorite was, one of them was that he was going to a wedding for a friend. And then he continued with the second one, the third one, the fourth one. And the fifth one turned out to be the friend got
married again.
He got divorced and was married again. So it's the same guy twice. But yeah, you know, that's one of the things is... people wondering, is Steve Schmidt there? Take a look behind the backstop, a little higher up, and you'll see him there. And you know what? I think he's loosening up now. And Vern knows this better than I do in terms of enjoying maybe a little bit more of what he's created now. I get that impression.
Absolutely.
He's up in his
70s
now.
It's fun it's late 70s. But yet, you know, at the same time, he's still the shoe salesman.
Yeah.
He's still the person that cares so much about what the fans are, whether they're enjoying themselves or not.
He's got a fascination with rope lights. So if you've ever driven by our stadium at night, it's always lit up. Steve personally puts those lights up. You know, he loves them. And there's a section of signage that goes up in our stadium right when you come in. Still to this day, he comes in with a group of guys from the shoebox, and they put those signs up themselves. And I don't know why. I mean, we could do it ourselves, but he does it. And it's kind of a testament, I think, to the style that he takes as an owner.
It might be my favorite chapter is talking to Steve about his background, his entire life. The shoebox is an iconic business in Wisconsin as a whole, and then what he's done with the Mallards is remarkable, and it's unheard of nationally. So there are 9 teams in the Northwoods League in Wisconsin.
And they've
emerged.
It's an amazing story, and I'll just close by saying, if you've ever been on Lake Eganza in the evening after dark and gone by Steve's house, all those string lights are going. Well, listen, this has been a lot of fun. Vern, thank you so much for coming by. Tom, thank you so much for the book and for being with us as well. It's been a real treat to have you both here. I hope we can do this again. It was a lot of fun. Tom Alicia, his book is titled Baseball Like It Ought to Be. And Vern Stenman, a very critical part of the book and president of the Madison Mallards and the Nightmares, which I wish we'd had time to talk about, but maybe next time we'll do it. All right. Thank you, guys. Coming up, we're going to talk disc golf. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're going to turn our attention to disc golf. Do you know that Wisconsin has more than 400 disc golf courses? In fact, one of them just hosted the U.S. Women's Disc Golf Championship 2 weekends ago in Manitowoc. So how did disc golf become such a big deal in our state? Larry Mueller here, and here to talk about disc golf's evolution is Jim Van Lannen. He is a board member of the Wisconsin Disc Sports Association and the founder of Discover Eastern Wisconsin Disc Golf. Jim was inducted into the Wisconsin Disc Golf Hall of Fame in 2011 and has assisted with the design and installation of many disc golf courses in our state. And as we talk with Jim, I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts. Let us know where you disc golf around the state, or maybe you just have you don't know anything about disc golf and want to learn something. Give us a call. What's your favorite disc in your bag? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Jim Van Lannen, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Hi, Larry. Nice to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. Before we start, let's clear up some potential confusion that somebody brought up with me. Frisbee golf or disc golfing, and there's a big difference between a disc and a frisbee. Talk about that.
It is. When I first started playing disc golf back in the 80s, they didn't have these sharp-edged frisbees, and they had just the rounded edge, the kind that you'd throw at the beach. And slowly, as golf got more popular, they figured out that if you have a more sharp edge, those discs will fly farther. And they also hurt when you catch them, so you're not going to be catching those very often. So that's the difference, and that was really developed the sport a lot in the early 80s.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. The terms used in disc golf are a lot like golfing with a golf ball in some ways, but they're, yeah. Talk about that.
Yes, it is. We call regular golf, we call that ball golf, because it's disc golf and ball golf.
Okay.
So, but in disc golf, we follow similar rules, but not exactly. But we're starting at a tee and we're terminating at a basket. And, you know, when the disc lands in the basket, you've successfully completed the hole. So other than that, you know, the flight and the way that the disc flies are completely different. A ball is going to go straight. It might shank left or right. But a frisbee is going to fly, and it's going to start on one angle. And then as it slows down, it changes its angle. So you have some really cool ways that you can throw a frisbee around trees and navigate through woods and stuff like that. So it makes a lot of fun.
Yeah, and the courses, like the championship courses of a couple of weeks ago, I mean, they're challenging, to say the least.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've come a long way. You know, I know the first course in the state was Valrath Park in Sheboygan. And if you go there now, it's still a great course, but those fairways are very close together. The fairways are short. And now with these new style of discs, you can out throw some of these holes. And so then you have to spread out a little bit to have the larger courses. A lot of our courses are still free though. So we're really, really happy that that's something that keeps the sport accessible to people.
How did you get involved in it?
Well, I started in college. I looked out of the dorm window and I saw some guys playing frisbee down in the quad and said, they must be cool people. So I went down and introduced myself. And they said, well, we're also playing this disc golf around campus. So we started throwing frisbees. And, you know, along the way, I met friends and those friends met more friends. And then I took my other friends and they introduced them. And now it's a big sport. It really did start just grassroots with a couple of guys just getting together and saying, hey, let's play from our college campus house all the way to one end of campus and back. And every 10 minutes we'd have to take a break because in between classes, they were walking on our fairway.
So, so that's how I got started.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's very grassroots. And a lot of the people that play freestyle and other overall disc sports also play disc golf. And ultimate is another disc sport that people will play one or both. And a lot of ultimate players, when they retire, they retire to playing disc golf, which is kind of cool. It's a little bit slower.
So it's the sport itself, disc golf, has really then evolved over the past decade or so.
Yeah, it sure has. The vision of Ed Hedrick back in the 70s of taking a Frisbee and having it change people's lives was true. And he took just a simple design and turned it from a toy into a sport disc. And he renamed the disc. He worked for WAMO at the time. And he renamed the disc the World Class and the Masters Frisbee. And he put lines on the top of it that made it fly more stable. And that technology increase and also the marketing of that changed. So you had something that was called the Little Abner. And that first disc, it was just a toy. And now you have the Masters Frisbee and these discs that actually fly stable and predictably.
It's pretty cool. And they have and you're not using, you know, people who play it a lot are going to have more than one disc.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's driver, mid-range, putter. There's some that like to go left, some that like to go right, and you need to know which one you're going to pull out of your bag for any particular shot. And that also depends on what's in your way. If there's a sand trap or trees or things in your way or water carry that you have to do, you have to pick the right disc to make sure that you're going to land on the fairway.
And if you don't land on the fairway...
Then we call that scrambling. Yeah. If you hit a tree and you get shanked into the woods in the shul, then you're scrambling. So those are all disc golf terms. I'm not sure if they use those in ball golf or not.
But you have to play it where it lies.
Yes. Yes. You throw it, and as long as you're in bounds, you throw from where you lie. You mark with a marker disc and then you play through from there.
And you need to always hit from behind that marker disc, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. Yep.
So how many people, well, where does Wisconsin stand when it comes to disc golf in terms of the numbers and so forth?
Yeah, we're very proud to say that we're number 4 in the nation for states on how many courses we have. We have 469 courses in the state of Wisconsin, and we're only sitting behind Texas, Michigan, and California. And for Michigan and Wisconsin to be in winter states and have more courses to play than all of these southern states is something that is very proud for us.
Yeah, I would think so. And it actually, ball golf is kind of the same way. It's amazing how many courses there are in the winter states like Minnesota and Wisconsin. And I think Wisconsin has something like 8 of the top 20 golf courses in the U.S. are in Wisconsin. So I would think if you held the national championship here in this, our courses, probably the whole range in terms of ability and openness and so forth.
Yeah, we do have the whole range. Silver Creek Park has 36 holes. It exposes to the beach on Lake Michigan, and we have one hole that is our lighthouse hole. It's our signature hole. It's our Pebble Beach of disc golf in Wisconsin. And it's got a 6-foot lighthouse that lights up at night, and you can play that hole every day of the year. And it's available all the time, and it's in a free city park. So it's really a wonderful thing to have that available to the local players.
Jim Van Lannen, our guest today, he is a board member of the Wisconsin Disc Sports Association. And he's going to be with us right up until 12:30, if I'm not mistaken. We will be talking with him, and you can join in with your own thoughts and questions. I hope you will. Number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Jim Van Lannen. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking about disc golf and where you can do it here in Wisconsin with our guest, Jim Van Lannen. Jim is a board member of the Wisconsin Disc Sports Association, founder of Discover Eastern Wisconsin Disc Golf. And Jim was inducted into the Wisconsin Disc Hall of Fame in 2011 and helped and assisted with the design and installation of many disc golf courses in our state. As we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Tell us about how you got started in it, or what's the best advice you've received on how to throw it better or further, maybe. Or maybe what's your favorite course. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Nate in Sheboygan is with us. Let's go there and see what's on Nate's mind. Hi, Nate.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Oh, I tuned in and heard you guys were talking disc golf and thought I'd share, since you're asking about favorite courses. I've played and lived in a number of places in Wisconsin. Started in Marshfield at just a real small course. It was a par 3 course at a local pool, public pool, HEFCO. That's since gone. Madison, if anybody's in the Madison area, High Stand and Elber, of course, are great courses. And now I'm in Sheboygan, and there are two that I frequent, one being Volrath and the other being the Quarry. All great courses.
Oh, Nate, thanks a lot for calling. Jim, do you want to comment on those courses or on his comments?
Yeah, Madison has some of the best courses around. They've really done some awesome things with design there. And a couple of my good friends are the designers of some of those courses. So they get a lot of play down there. They're serious about disc golf in Madison. Sheboygan is also close to my heart because I started going to the disc golf overall tournament there in the late 70s. And we have the longest running disc golf tournament in the state of Wisconsin was held in Sheboygan, the state overall championships. And they used to throw discs off the hill and have the dogs catching discs and the guts players throwing and doing exhibitions. And they really, really knew how to have a fun event for the family. And they had the Bratwurst City Frisbee Club was running that event back in the 70s. So,
Nate, thank you for calling. Paul and Merrill, we'll go to you next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Just want to say, and maybe your guest knows about this, but this morning I was in Riverside Park in Merrill alongside the Wisconsin River, and I walked in an area I'd never walked in before in that park. Big, expansive lawn, huge trees, big maple trees, oak trees, and so on. And it's a disc golf place. And I was just totally impressed with how open and beautiful that park is, and wondering if your guest knows of it.
Hmm.
I've not been to Merrill, but I do know that a lot of those old growth forests are perfect. They, you know, the trees aren't negatively impacted by discs hitting them, and they give you lots of obstacles to throw around. And what's neat about disc golf is that you're able to design and put in disc golf courses that can coexist with existing uses of parks and also along with nature. So we're looking at safety and multiple uses, which is very important when we're designing the courses, to make sure that they keep our parks looking nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, thank you so much for calling. And Alex had also called to give a shout-out to the course at the Nisida Outdoor Adventure Club. He says that's a great course as well. Are you familiar with that course in Nisida?
I am not. I don't get too far away. That's you can tell by the name of my club. It's Discover Eastern Wisconsin. I have friends there that maintain a lot of those parks and are more influential on the west side of the state. And so we each kind of take our niche. And I've got good friends in Randy Shukar up in Standing Rocks in Stevens Point. And you got Brad Wendt down in Madison. and Josh Hamm down in Milwaukee, and a lot of these people that each take care of their own areas. You know, John Turlap in Appleton, and it works very well that we, you know, kind of adopt our parks in our local areas, and that's how you keep those parks looking nice.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of volunteer effort involved, as I understand it, anywhere in the state for those courses.
Yeah, as is typical in, you know, municipal funding, funds go down and volunteers can pick up the slack. And so disc golf has done that as well, trying to make sure that we are making our parks look nicer year in and year out. And it's a lot of brush cutting and pushing back the invasive species and things like that. They keep those parks looking nice.
Frank in Springbrook, we'll go to you now. Frank, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a question for your expert there. I am a semi-retired local reporter in Northwest Wisconsin. And, you know, about a dozen years ago or so, there was a lot of interest, a lot of talk about disc golf course. And I know we had our big lodge up here in Washburn County at the Heartwood. I think they even had a national tournament there once. So about a dozen years or so, there was a lot of discussion. You would see people playing disc golf. But now when I go to a park or places where there are disc golfs, I never see anybody playing. I just wonder, has the enthusiasm for that sport died down a little bit? Or is it in Wisconsin, is it kind of a regional thing where some areas have a lot of activity and some areas don't?
Mm-hmm.
Because even like the Berkey up here at the Telemark, the big development, Telemark Village, where they put $10 million into creating a new lodge and everything. They have a new disc golf course. I've been up there several times. And you see a lot of mountain bike riders. You see a lot of people hiking in the winter skiing. But I have yet to see anybody playing disc golf.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, one thing you're going to see is with the development of disc golf, you've got more courses and more choices for people to make. I'm not familiar with the course. Are you saying Washburn County as in Ashland up near the village of Highbridge?
Well, no, Washburn County, there was a big resort. It used to be called Heartwood. It's called something else now. The Catholic Church bought it. But okay. Back in the 2000s, they had a really nice disc golf course. I did a story on it, and they actually had a national tournament there at one time.
The one I'm thinking of is Highbridge Hills. It's up near Ashland, way in the northern part of the state. We had the World Championships up there in 2007.
Okay, so Frank brings up an interesting question. What's the popularity of disc golf here in the state?
You know, over the COVID era of 2020 and 2021, our numbers doubled because disc golf is a good COVID activity. It slowed down a little bit, but over the last 40 years, we've been in double-digit growth and continues to be double-digit growth. Both numbers of players and numbers of courses. So we're adding about 30 courses a year to the state of Wisconsin. And right now we've got 10,000 courses in the United States and 16,000 courses worldwide. So those numbers aren't slowing down at all. And we're adding more courses because people are looking for the sport. So yeah, it really hasn't slowed down much. And, you know, other than a little bit what we consider a slowdown because we were hitting unparalleled growth with COVID. And that's tailed back a little bit, but we're still continuing to grow. I think maybe some of those courses that you're talking about may have been, you know, during the week or in an off season. But I can just say for our courses in Manitowoc, we have 40,000 rounds of golf every year just at Silver Creek Park. And those people are coming from all over. You know, I'm quizzing them and asking, you know, where are you coming from? And they're driving from all over the state because they know that there's a championship level course in our community. So it really does benefit the communities to have the nice courses. And like anything else, you might have some courses that are not well kept or not maintained that could get less use based on the volunteer effort and the park's effort to maintain them. But for the most part, we've got some of the nicest courses in the Midwest here in Wisconsin.
Frank, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Maybe you could tell us about the U.S. Women's Disc Golf Championship. How did they choose Manitowoc for the location, and how'd the tournament go?
Sure. I would say persistence. We bid for that 3 years in a row, and the third year we won out. The event was held a week ago in Manitowoc, and it went over any of our goals. We had hoped to get 300 players. We had 330 players. We had hoped to get 100 volunteers. We had 150 volunteers. We had hoped to have 500 spectators. We had 1,500 spectators. So the numbers really prove out that people wanted this event in our area. And we're so proud that we brought it to a small community of Manitowoc and really are breaking records as far as the number of attendance for this women's only national event. It's a very prestigious event. There's only six majors in the country, in the world, all year long. And this is one of those six majors. Now, today we start the Masters World Championships in the Twin Cities, a much bigger community versus Manitowoc. I'd say probably 10 to 1. I don't know what the population is of the Twin Cities, but it's got to be more than 41,000. So to have a small community of Manitowoc hold one of these major tournaments was really a big thing for us. And we were very happy that the community and the Parks Department and the sponsors and everybody came together and really helped to put that event together. So it turned out very well, yeah.
And the quality, obviously, the quality of play had to be wonderful as well. Do you talk about under par, over par, or, you know, how do you measure?
Sure. Under par is always good.
Yeah. You
know? We're all trying to shave strokes. We had our winner was from Finland. And she beat a girl that was originally from Wisconsin who now lives in North Carolina. Evelina Salonen is from Finland, and Haley King is from Wisconsin. And then our Masters division, we had Jennifer Allen from Arizona, who beat out in the tiebreaker Holly Finley, who is also from Wisconsin, and now lives, I think, in Nashville, somewhere around there. But so these people are coming from all over the world, and it was cool that we had two of the top finishers in the top level divisions were originally from Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Maureen in Manitowoc, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to call to say that my mom used to live across from Estabrook Park in Milwaukee. Now my daughter lives about a block away. And I see people there playing disc golf all the time. It's a beautiful course. So I guess I'm refuting that guy that says that he doesn't see it being played very much anymore. I think it's a great sport. I personally have tried it a little bit, but it's fun to see people outside and enjoying the woods and enjoying the parks.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Maureen. Comment, Jim?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, Estabrook is a beautiful park, and it's just a good testament for if you have a nice park and a good relationship with the Parks Department, that you can create some really cool things. And I think Manitowoc is a prime example of that as well. Silver Creek Park is 85 acres. We put in 36 holes there. We've got a championship course that lays on top of those 36 holes. We call it the Super Silver Course. And the city has been on board since day one. And they allow us to make enough changes that we can keep it competitive. And as long as we don't ask for money, they think it's great. Because we come in with labor and sponsors and say we want to get these projects done. And they say, okay, let's do it. So it's been just a really good relationship. And it would be a good example for other communities that how we're working with the city.
John wonders, what's the typical length of a course? And you, yeah, and you have, I'm sure, par 5 maybe, or a par 4, par 3, that sort of thing.
Yeah, in general terms, you'd say ball golf, you talk in yards, and about the same distance as in disc golf, you'd talk in feet. So 200 feet to 1,000 feet is a typical disc golf hole. So, and par 3, 4, and 5. Our finishing hole for U.S. women's was a par 5, 779 feet, and it was a very competitive hole. You also have, I think, the shorter hole, probably 275 feet for the top women, and you put some challenges in front of them as well, put them on hills and put water around it and some obstacles, making it more challenging. So it's not always about the distance. It can be about what the obstacles are on that course as well.
So I'm now thinking about ball golf versus disc golf. If I hit a golf ball into the water, I just pull out another one. How does that work with disc golf?
Same way. Yeah. You either that or you roll up your pants and go swimming. You know, you can go and try and find them. We did have at Rolling Ridge course for U.S. women's. We had a gentleman with waders on, and he sat in the pond all weekend. And if you threw in the water, he would throw it back to you. So, yeah. So shout out to Champ at Rolling Ridge Disc Golf Course. We're doing that all weekend long. And he did a great job.
What about course etiquette? Anything? What can you tell us about any disc golf course etiquette you should know about?
Sure. Well, you know, first thing, we want to think about the park, and we don't want to disturb nature. We don't want to break things. We don't want to break, you know, branches. We don't want to disturb the animal life in the park, but we also want to be safe. So you don't want to be throwing on top of the group in front of you. Give people adequate space so that they're not getting hit with a Frisbee. And then also keeping the parks clean. We want to leave the parks as nice as we found them. So it's important for us to be thinking about, you know, if we brought it in, why don't we take it home with us versus leaving it behind in the park for somebody else to pick up? So all of those things are very important.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You've competed in, I'm sure, many tournaments over the years. How do you prepare for something like that? I'm thinking nerves and everything else, but how do you prepare?
You know, I was watching a video yesterday of Simon Lazat, and he's from Germany, now lives in Massachusetts, great golfer, and he does a blog explaining his preparation for a tournament. And he's the day before the tournament, he said, this is how you do this. I wasn't throwing enough last week, so I have to get repetition. So he said he's going to throw 100 discs. You know, and it only takes 15 or 20 minutes. So you can throw those discs, and that muscle memory is what gives you the same repeat when you come up to the hole and you're ready to throw. Just put the mind on block and say, I'm just going to throw and do what the muscles remember to do. Throw it straight at the basket, right? So, but repetition and practice is really what it comes to.
On courses, are there sometimes trees or other obstacles that may be right in front or near a space where you need to get?
Yeah, and we've got different ways. You can throw forehand, backhand, overhead. There's some different throws that you can throw to get the disc out of trouble. You can also put your foot behind your marker. And you can lay down and lean out around something. So if you can imagine sticking your toe out as far as you could and leaning way over and throwing it, get flicking it around, that does happen. And as long as your foot is behind that marker disc, you're okay.
And the discs themselves, like for a par 3 disc, is that a smaller disc? Or, I mean, what makes one disc different from another?
Well, I mentioned earlier about the rim being thinner and more sharp-edged. Those sharp-edged discs are going to go farther. So the mid-range disc is going to be a little thicker, and then a putter will be even thicker yet. So, and what you get with the thicker disc is stability. And so if you're throwing a stable disc, it means it's going to throw straight. It's going to continue to go straight until it almost finishes a little bit at the end when it slows down. Those sharper edge discs are going to have less predictability. So you have to have more control over those high, what we call high speed discs. So the narrow edge, you have higher speed, you can throw them harder and they go a lot farther.
What is the cost in terms of equipment and so forth? That the discs, I assume, are the main cost.
Sure. Well, I know people that have, you know, invested their retirement in discs, but at the same time, I also know a guy that went to the park one day and just walked around for a while, and he found one that didn't have a name on it, and so he started throwing it. But his investment was zero. But somewhere in between. Most golfers, I would say, with a bag would have 15 or 20 to 30 discs in a bag, and those bags average from $10 to $25. So about $500. If you have a nice bag, it might be another $300. So less than $1,000, you're geared up for the season. Now, you don't want to throw it around too many ponds, or you might lose a few of them.
But, but are they fairly stable? I mean, do they get nicked up a lot and you got to replace them a lot or not?
A little bit, but that's actually a good thing. We call that being beaten in. When you beat in a disc, it flies a little bit different. So it might fly over stable, but when it's beat in, it'll throw a little more under stable. So it's going to turn left or turn right a little bit more or less. So you might have a brand new Wildcat, and then that beat in Wildcat's going to throw a little different. So, but you'll keep them both in your bag because you know how each of them throws. So we keep throwing them until they break it most of the time.
Oh, Bill in Oregon, he's played disc golf for over 40 years. Great excuse to be outside. He talks about the several courses around Madison. Elver Park, he particularly likes a tricky 18-hole course. And Token Creek County Park and Bird's Ruins in Marshall are wonderful 36-hole golf courses. I like the name Bird's Ruins in Marshall.
Yeah, I can't say enough about Madison's courses. They have we're all jealous around the state of Madison that they've got some of the nicest courses around. Very competitive, very challenging, difficult courses. Token Creek is a beautiful, big county park, and they have 36 holes. Elver Park was the first course in Madison, and that was designed by a couple of friends of mine. And I remember really well, it was 1992, I get a call from my buddy Pete. He says, Jim, you're never going to believe it. The Parks Board is going to let me design a course on the ski. There's a hill and a big park and there's a pond and just a great piece of land. And we're going to have disc golf in Madison. And that course went in September of 1992. And that was the first year of the Wisconsin Tour. And that Wisconsin Tour played where Madison played Milwaukee and Appleton played Sheboygan. And so you had teams in these four cities played each other. And now that tour is 21 cities and a summer-long Wisconsin Tour that we're very proud of 35 years later.
Oh, man. It's a wonderful story, Jim. And I have more questions for you, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us and taking a half hour to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Larry. Appreciate it. You have a great day.
You as well. Jim Van Lannen, board member of the Wisconsin Disc Sports Association. Great to have him with us, and I'm sure we'll be getting him back to talk about it again at some point down the road. Coming up, though, we're going to talk about competitive and show water skiing. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We go now to the world of show skiing. It's a type of water skiing involving some jaw-dropping stunts. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on WPR. Our guest today knows a whole lot about show skiing. He's president of the Rock Aqua Jays out of Janesville. Tim Cullen, it's great to have. It'll be great to talk with him today. Tim will tell us more about the Aqua Jays, what they do, and what's behind all their success. They are 23-time national champions, after all, so they know obviously a lot about it. Are you a fan of competitive water skiing? Have you seen water skiing shows or competitions in Wisconsin? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Tim Cullen, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Larry. I really look forward to the conversation.
Yeah, I do as well. How does a water skiing competition work?
Well, this is kind of fun because a lot of people have the idea of what a water ski show is based on what Tommy Bartlett had done for many, many years up in the Dells. And so what happened about 1975 is we started a national tournament in Janesville. And show skiing, for tournament-wise, you get 60 minutes to put on your very best water ski show. And you put it to like a play or a musical or a movie. So it has a theme to it. And then you have that 1 hour to perform different acts like pyramids and barefooting and jumping, ballet acts. It's all choreographed. It's all got music to it, costumes. It's just a unique sport, I'll say that.
Yeah, it is indeed. I've had a chance, living in Madison, I've had a chance to watch the Mad City ski team.
Sure.
Many times they'll perform on a Sunday afternoon or a Saturday afternoon, and it's always fun to watch them in action. And they've been fairly successful as well, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, yes. They're a very good team. Madison is a very competitive team. Between them and a couple others, there's some really top, good, talented teams in Wisconsin that we'll have to do our best in order to come out on top this year.
Well, you're president of the Rock Aqua Jays water ski show team. What's your role as president?
Oh, gosh. As president, it seems like I have to do a lot. But we have a team of about 185 members, and we spread around that work and responsibility. So that helps a lot. But I'm in charge of overseeing the business side of the sport, I guess you would call it, because we have the show side, and we have a show director for that. I'm more for the side of making sure we have the funds needed, the insurance coverage, the sponsors that help support us, and then keeping track of all that to make sure it runs smoothly, because we are an organization that's been around since 1961, and I've been president many times. I love the organization, and I love the people, and especially really enjoy working with the people of Janesville, whether it's the city, the parks director, or the city manager. We get great support from the city.
And how did you get involved in all this? Were you a water skier yourself?
I was a water skier. I skied in the shows from like 1983 through 2003. And then my knees and my back said, that's enough. And so I had plenty of years on the water and enjoyed skiing, and now I'm a boat driver for the team. So I still participate and compete, but I'm just, you know, in a different capacity. My dad drove boat for the team for almost 40 years, and that's how we got involved. He joined the team in 1977, and he was a boat driver since then. And so, when the family joined, I joined and got involved and had just a great time water skiing.
I think there's, aren't there even awards for boat driving?
That's right. In fact, we have a boat driving award. You have an announcing sound award. My brother is, my oldest brother, he's the announcer for the team. He's probably the most decorated national champion announcer out there, because he's been doing it pretty much since 1986. And so, we have a lot of longevity. There's a lot of families on our team that if you stick around for 1 year, you stick around for 10 years or more. And that's how we continue on and build the team.
Yeah, I wondered about that. You've won the national championship 23 times. What makes your program so strong year after year?
Well, thank you for recognizing that. I would say it is because it is a family sport, and we promote that family atmosphere, because if you're under 16, you have to join with one parent. But I think it's ingrained in our culture that we want to do well. If we're going to put time out there, we want to compete, and we want to win. Not that other teams don't want to win, but I think we have the foundation to make a successful year with our competitive attitude, and then our production of costumes and music, and then the execution with the boat driving and how we do our acts, and all that combines to have sometimes luck, sometimes it's good preparation, sometimes both of that. But to win 23 national titles, there's only been 49 national tournaments. We're pretty proud of that.
I would think so. You know, you mentioned costumes, and I'm recalling an interview I had last week with Mike Beno, who's editor of Our Wisconsin magazine, and they had a story in the magazine about a gal by the name of Kate Drager of Saner.
Sure.
Who has made over 6,000 costumes.
I can imagine she. I know who that is, and I would think our team has made at least that many. But hopefully, I think we spread it out amongst more than one individual. Thank goodness. Otherwise, man, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, she makes costumes, I guess, for several teams, probably in her area, but sometimes out of her area as well. And they use a Lycra.
Yes. Yep. Oh, yeah. You want to use a really light, stretchy material because when that gets wet, it makes it a little tricky to use. But here's the fun thing is, Larry, is this summer our show is based on the old TV show called Hee Haw. You probably remember that.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then we call it Ski Haw just because we're fun like that, I guess. And the guys are wearing denim overalls. Well, not really stretchy material, is it? But they got good protection in case they hit the water hard, but not the best thing for water, that's for sure.
No. So that's the how do you decide on a theme for a show?
Well, that's fun. The fun part of it is the show director has probably a couple ideas, and they change it each year. And so they come in, and this year is David Raisin. He comes in last September and says, okay, we're going to do Ski Haw. And he's worked on it. And then, you know, it could be a movie. We've tried something like Toy Story, and last year was Ghostbusters. That was a lot of fun to do. And then we can make up original ones like we have in the past, you know, loose interpretation of a play or like something very unique, like a color rush, color teams, I guess you'd call it. And, yeah, it's just whoever has the great idea to bring it forward, and then you have to make it come alive.
That's great. Tim Cullen, our guest today, president of the Rock Aqua Jays Water Ski Show Team. Join in with your own questions or comments or maybe an experience to share. Love to hear from you. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at water skiing today and zeroing in a bit on show skiing. It's a competitive sport, and our guest today to talk about it, Tim Cullen, president of Rock Aqua Jays Water Ski Show Team. Great to have him with us. Tomorrow on the show, just a quick mention here, Scott Craven returns to give you an update on Wisconsin wildlife. And you'll hear the story of how a Wisconsin farm family takes care of their land. So we're looking forward to that as well. Right now, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I assume, I got a question from John. I assume that preparation is big. It involves a lot of things, not only just sort of basics, but then how do you design all of these unique routines that are done?
Yeah, the part about the preparation and the practice of it, it does take a long time. It's more than just a couple of days here. So we actually start indoor practices in November of each year, every other weekend, at an indoor gymnastics place. That way you can practice building the pyramids that you do and the routines and getting all the choreography down and just the repetition of it over and over. Because you get some new members out there and just want to get the people in mind of how they do that act. But, yeah, it's the practicing of it. And then once we get to May, then we get on the water, and then we do practices twice a week, Monday, Tuesday night. And then we have shows starting in Memorial Day weekend, and we do shows Sunday and Wednesday. So we get a lot of practices, a lot of shows in there throughout the summer, and it just makes it for a labor of love.
Yeah, I live near Lake Monona here, and I often see, I'm sure there are members of the Mad City Ski Team out there practicing, and I'm usually out there very early in the morning, like 6-ish, and and they're out there cruising around the lakes, around the lake, and it's fun to kind of watch them. Walk us through some of the best stunts your team can do.
Oh, sure. We pride ourselves on a couple key acts. We like to think we have an overall show that's very good. But I'll take the one that you'll see twice in our show is our pyramid. So the ending pyramid of the show will have one boat, and it's a good-sized boat, obviously, has 300 Mercury engines on them. And so that's 900 horsepower, and it's great because Mercury is a Wisconsin company up in Fond du Lac, right?
Yeah.
Great, great company, great product that they make. So that one boat alone will pull a 50-person pyramid from a sitting dock start. So you have to have a lot of horsepower and coordination to pull off 50 people off the dock at one time. And they will build up 3-4-tier pyramids or more, depending on what we can do that summer. So that is one big key event. And then we'll do a girls' ballet act in the show. And that ballet act will have 30 girls out there on the water one time. They take off the dock on a single ski, go around a few times, and come back to shore. They do a routine on the dock. They do a routine on the shore. And that's pretty impressive to see that type of activity behind one boat with that many skiers. It's really, really impressive. Then you have to make sure it's safe and coordinated. So that makes it a trickier act to do, too. And then I'll say two more quick acts, one of them being our barefoot line. So we have two boats with 300 engines on them. So there are two of the triple rigs, we call them. One of them pulls the pyramids. The other one pulls our barefoot line. The barefoot line act is usually all guys. It has about 20 guys barefoot skiing at the same time behind one boat. There's a Guinness Book of World Record of that. We hosted a couple of those one time. But in our normal show, you'll see about 20 behind the boat. And that's pretty neat. And then the last one I'll feature is our jump act. We have guys going off the jump doing front flips, back flips, one ski, two ski, a Mobius, one ski back flip with a full twist. It's amazing what they can do off a jump. And as a former jumper myself, I'm just in awe of what they can do out there.
I would think so. You know, and these pyramids are what intrigue me a bit, because you might have, like you said, three or four high.
Yeah, right. And
they're all being pulled. How do you get started with that? Because there's different, you know, it's hard to imagine how it gets started.
Right. It is unique that way. So all the guys start on skis and all the girls start on the guys' shoulders. And so let's say you have 24 guys skiing, you have 24 girls on top of them. And then the girls climb up and do the pyramid formation. And that's where the coordination and the practice comes into play, because it doesn't go straight up. It kind of leans back a little bit, obviously. And so the higher up you go, the longer rope you have to have. We have a great video out there on YouTube. You can find this, Rock Aqua J's Pyramid. And the girl on the top of the pyramid wore a GoPro video on her head. And it made me appreciate how much I was being on the bottom of that pyramid, because I would never climb up on someone's shoulders going 30 miles an hour up 4 or 5 tiers high. That's really crazy to do.
It is indeed, and there's many opportunities for disaster to occur, I would think.
It is tricky. Yeah, it gets tricky, and safety is obviously number one goal, and then you know, the execution of it and make sure it happens in the right way. But it does take a lot of practice.
And it can hurt if you go. I'll share one. I was going wide open, and I don't remember. I don't know how fast we were going, but it was really fast. And I was doing some little jumps and over wakes, and I got a tip down.
Oh.
In the water, and that took care of my knee for the rest of the rest of the summer. So it's a sport. I mean, all right, you're falling in water, but you can still get injured.
Oh, for sure. When you come down off a jump that high up in the air, or like you're saying, you catch a tip, or you're out barefooting, that water can feel like concrete. So you're right. The pain of hitting the water is nice to be on water, but when you're going that fast and unexpected, it's hard to brace for it. And that's where most injuries occur. A lot of eardrums get damaged because if you hit the water, turn your head. That force of water is not good. Shoulders are problems, and knees, of course. Yeah,
I would think so. So I was going to ask you, how dangerous is the sport?
It obviously has inherent dangers with it there, but luckily, you have the precautions of wetsuits and flotation, and a lot of these acts that require releases in the boat. So the person, if they're holding someone above their head like a doubles routine, they would pull release and not be injured. So there's definitely some inherent injury in there. We tell people at the beginning of our show, do not practice these on your own. Please ask for assistance or join the team, and we'll be glad to teach you how to do this, because we might make it look easy, but it is pretty difficult.
I can believe that. Believe me. I thought I was doing pretty good when I could just start as an individual off the pier.
That's good.
I was a lot younger then. I wouldn't try it now, that's for sure. Oh, man. What about specialized equipment? What special equipment do you use that a recreational water skier might not recognize?
Oh, sure. There's everything from the jump skis. Obviously, you have to have a specific type of ski that's secure to your foot, flexible enough to hit the ramp, and then have a small rudder on it. So jump skis are out there. Then the girls use swivel skis, where the ski stays stationary, but the binding can swivel around 360 degrees. And that is unique. A lot of these skis now are also pretty big and light because different materials over the years have changed. So you have that part of it. And then, like I said, you have helmets, you have wetsuits, you have the rope itself, of course, and then the boats. So there's a ton of equipment that goes into it. And then when you get to a team like our size, and the Madison team, you have a big budget to maintain all that. And it's not cheap, and it's all for the love of a sport that you do pretty much just 3 months of the year and perform for the public. Even though you can practice all year, you really condense it down to 3 months of the whole year.
Yeah, I would think so. And back to those costumes for a minute, because I wonder do you have somebody, a specialist, make those for you, or does everybody kind of make their own a bit?
Well, great question. We're fortunate on our team to have three or four good seamstresses that really enjoy making costumes. Well, obviously, we can reuse some, but yeah, they'll have to make new costumes for a pyramid that has 50-some people in it, or a ballet act that has 30-some people in it. So, yeah, we make our own, so that saves a lot of money. But, we're very fortunate like that. Some teams don't have that, and then they can buy them at rummage sale that we have for our show skiers, or they can pay to have them made also.
Yeah. And you mentioned boat driving earlier. What makes a good boat driver?
Well, I like to think it's a person who is conscious of, the safety of the acts of the people they are pulling, but then also watching ahead of them, because we do a couple of acts where you have multiple boats, four or five, six boats at one time, pulling a lot of skiers. So the coordination with, on the radio, the getting the speed right, making sure everybody's safe, and then just hitting the speed and the pattern that the skier needs to be successful. That's tricky, especially when you have so many variables happening at the same time. So it takes a lot of effort and coordination to practice that routine. And if we're lucky to have multiple drivers on our team that can do all that, plus we have a few backups in case we really need it. But, yeah, it's that's a tough part, this tough part to do. And if we're noticed, if the boat driver gets noticed, that means we probably didn't do a good job because you should be watching the skier behind us. Yeah.
Cheryl emailed that her kids ski with the Mad City water ski team. The entire family's involved, and this year they were fortunate enough to go to Australia to compete in the World Show ski event. They won.
Yeah, the USA team is fantastic. And, you know, just like Mad City ski team and Janesville, we encourage all the like family memberships, and it's the weirdest sport where you can be, let's say, 10 years old out there water skiing in our show, and your dad can be right there with you, or your mom can be. It's a very weird sport where the whole family can actually participate and compete at the same time. It's not like, you know, softball where the 12-year-old out there playing softball, mom and dad are in the crowd. You can actually be in the same sport with your kids. And I think that's what makes show skiing unique and special.
You're hosting the 50th National Water Ski Show Championships in, I think it's August 8th through the 10th this year.
That's correct.
What can people expect to see?
Oh, thank you. This is our big premier event of the summer. It is the 50th tournament. It started in Janesville in 1975. And so this year we're starting on Friday, August 8th. That will be an individual competition. Then we'll have an opening ceremony. That'll be something special to this event. So come down to Janesville Traxa Park August 8th, 9th, and 10th. 8th is individuals, and 9th and 10th will have 14 teams competing for the national championship, and hopefully we'll get a great turnout from Janesville, Madison, and the surrounding area.
I'm betting that you'll have a good team. How do your a good number of people there? How are your prospects?
Well, I think it's okay. You know, we take a lot of pride in what we do. So does every other team out there, but. You know, I think our skiers are a little more geared up this year, knowing it's the 50th in our home site. We haven't had a national tournament in Janesville in many years because we wanted to host the 50th tournament. And so I think we're going to put a little extra into this one.
I bet you are, Tim. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I can tell from your enthusiasm, you haven't lost any enthusiasm for this sport.
I love it. It's a great sport to be a part of, and I would encourage anybody to go see the Madison Show or us in Janesville. There's like 30 teams around Wisconsin alone, so you can't go too far without finding a show ski team.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I was just knowing from that interview I had last week that there are several in northern Wisconsin as well.
Sure is. You know, Tomahawks, Attack, all those areas up there have a team of some level, and please patronize them also.
Tim, thank you very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Let's do this again down the road. Thank you.
I would love it. Thank you, Larry. Have a good day.
You as well. Tim Cullen, president of the Rock Aqua Jays water ski show team. They do they're really good. Really good. And so is the Madison City water ski team and many other teams around the state, for sure, do a great job, and they're always fun to watch. Tomorrow on the show, Scott Craven's back to talk about Wisconsin wildlife. You'll hear a story of how a farm family takes care of its land. That's tomorrow. And thank you for joining us today. This and all our shows are a team effort. Our producers are Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. And hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.